I replied, "It was the easiest task I ever performed, because most of the work had been done before I took hold of it. In fact, I didn't do it. B did it himself." This man looked at me in bewilderment. He did not see that which I am here trying to make clear, namely, that practically all difficult tasks are easily performed if one approaches them from the right angle. There were two important factors entering B's release. The first was the fact that he had supplied the material for a good case before I took it in charge. And the second was the fact that before I called on the governor of Ohio, I so completely convinced myself that I had a right to ask for B's release, that I had no difficulty in presenting my case effectively. Go back to what was stated in the beginning of this lesson on the subject of telepathy and apply it to this case. The governor could tell long before I had stated my mission that I knew I had a good case. If my brain did not telegraph this thought to his brain, then the look of self-confidence in my eyes and the positive tone of my voice made obvious my belief in the merits of the case. Again, I apologize for these personal references with the explanation that I have used them only because the whole of America was familiar with the B case that I have described. I disclaim all credit for the small part I played in the case, for I did nothing except use my imagination as assembly room in which to piece together the factors out of which the sale was made. I did nothing except that which any salesman of imagination could have done. It requires considerable courage to prompt one to use the personal pronoun as freely as it has been used in relating the fact connected with this case. But justification lies in the value of application of the principle of imagination to a case with which nearly everyone is familiar. I cannot recall an incident in my entire life in connection with which the soundness of the 15 factors that entered into this reading course was more clearly manifested than it was in securing the release of B. It is but another link in the long chain of evidence that proves to my entire satisfaction the power of imagination as a factor in salesmanship. There are endless millions of approaches to every problem, but there is only one best approach. Find this one best approach and your problem is easily solved. No matter how much merit your goods may have, there are millions of wrong ways in which to offer them. Your imagination will assist you in finding the right way. In your search for the right way in which to offer your merchandise or your services, remember this peculiar trait of mankind. Men will grant favors that you request for the benefit of a third person, when they would not grant them if requested for your benefit. Compare this statement with the fact that I asked the governor of Ohio to release B, not as a favor to me, and not as a favor to B, but for the benefit of 160,000 unfortunate inmates of the prisons of America. Salesmen of imagination always offer their wares in such terminology that the advantages of these wares to the prospective purchasers are obvious. It is seldom that any man makes a purchase of merchandise or renders another a favor just to accommodate that salesman. It is a prominent trait of human nature that prompts us all to do that which advances our own interest. This is a cold, indisputable fact, claims of the idealist to the contrary notwithstanding. To be perfectly plain, men are selfish. To understand the truth is to understand how to present your case, whether you are asking for the release of a man from prison or offering for sale some commodity. In your own imagination, so plan your presentation with your case that the strongest and most impelling advantages to the buyer are made plain. This is imagination. A farmer moved to the city, taking with him his well-trained shepherd dog. He soon found that the dog was out of place in the city, so he decided to get rid of him. Taking the dog with him, he went out into the country and rapped on the door of a farmhouse. A man came hobbling to the door on crutches. The man with the dog greeted the man in the house in these words, "You wouldn't care to buy a fine shepherd dog that I wish to get rid of, would you?" The man on crutches replied, "No," and closed the door. The man with the dog called at half a dozen other farmhouses, asking the same question and received the same answer. He made up his mind that no one wanted the dog and returned to the city. That evening he was telling of his misfortune to a man of imagination. The man heard how the owner of the dog had tried in vain to get rid of him. "Let me dispose of the dog for you," said the man of imagination. The owner was willing. The next morning the man of imagination took the dog out into the country and stopped at the first farmhouse, at which the owner of the dog had called the day before. The same old man hobbled out on crutches and answered the knock on the door. The man of imagination greeted him in this fashion. "I see you are all crippled with rheumatism. What you need is a fine dog to run errands for you. I have a dog here that has been trained to bring home the cows, drive away wild animals, herd the sheep, and perform other useful services. You may have this dog for $100. "All right," said the crippled man, "I'll take him." That, too, was imagination. No one wants a dog that someone else wants to get rid of. But most anyone would like to own a dog that would herd sheep and bring home the cows and perform other useful services. The dog was the same one that the crippled buyer had refused the day before. But the man who sold the dog was not the man who tried to get rid of him. If you use your imagination, you will know that no one wants anything that someone else is trying to get rid of. Remember that which was said about the law of attraction through the operation of which like attracts like. If you look and act the part of a failure, you will attract nothing but failure. Whatever your life work may be, it calls for the use of imagination. Niagara Falls was nothing but a great mass of roaring water until a man of imagination harnessed it and converted the wasted energy into electric current that now turns the wheels of industry. Before this man of imagination came along, millions of people had seen and heard these roaring falls, but lacked the imagination to harness them. The first Rotary Club of the world was born in the fertile imagination of Paul Harris of Chicago, who saw in this child of his brain an effective means of cultivating prospective clients and the extension of his law practice. The ethics of the legal profession forbid advertising in the usual way. But Paul Harris' imagination found a way to extend his legal practice without advertising in the usual way. "In the winds of fortune are temporarily blowing against you, remember that you can harness them and make them carry you toward your definite purpose. Through the use of your imagination, a kite rises against the wind, not with it." Dr. Frank Crane was a struggling third-rate preacher, until the starvation wages of the clergy forced him to use his imagination. Now he earns upward of $100,000 a year for an hour's work a day, writing essays. Bud Fisher once worked for a mere pittance, but now he earns $75,000 a year by making folks grin with his Mutton Jeff comic strip. No art goes into his drawings, therefore he must be selling his imagination. Woolworth was a poorly paid clerk in a retail store, poorly paid perhaps because he had not yet found out that he had imagination. Before he died, he built the tallest office building in the world and girdled the United States with 5- and 10-cent stores through the use of his imagination. You will observe by analyzing these illustrations that a close study of human nature played an important part in the achievements mentioned. To make profitable use of your imagination, you must make it give you a keen insight into the motives that cause men to do or refrain from doing a given act. If your imagination leads you to understand how quickly people grant your requests when these requests appeal to their self-interest, you can have practically anything you go after. I saw my wife make a very clever sale to our baby not long ago. The baby was pounding the top of our mahogany library table with a spoon. When my wife reached for the spoon, the baby refused to give it up. But being a woman of imagination, she offered the baby a nice stick of red candy. He dropped the spoon immediately and centered his attention on the more desirable object. That was imagination. It was also salesmanship. She won her point without using force. I was riding in an automobile with a friend who was driving beyond the speed limit. An officer rode up on a motorcycle and told my friend he was under arrest for speeding. The friend smiled pleasantly at the officer and said, "I'm sorry to have brought you out in all this rain, but I wanted to make the 10 o'clock train with my friend here, and I was hitting it up around 35 miles an hour." "No, you were only going 28 miles an hour," replied the officer, "and as long as you are so nice about it, I will let you off this time if you'll watch yourself thereafter." And that, too, was imagination. Even a traffic cop will listen to reason when approached in the right manner. But woe unto the motorist who tries to bully the cop into believing his speedometer was not registering properly. There is one form of imagination against which I would caution you. It is the brand which prompts some people to imagine that they can get something for nothing, or that they can force themselves ahead in the world without observing the rights of others. There are more than 160,000 prisoners in the Penal Institute of the United States, practically every one of whom is in prison because he imagined he could play the game of life without observing the rights of his fellow men. There is a man in the Ohio Penitentiary who has served more than 35 years of time for forgery, and the largest amount he ever got from his misapplication of imagination was $12. There are a few people who direct their imaginations in the vain attempt to work out a way to show what happens when an immovable body comes in contact with an irresistible force, but these types belong in the psychopathic hospitals. There is also another form of misapplied imagination, namely that of the young boy or girl who knows more about life than his or her dad. But this form is subject to modification with time. My own boys have taught me many things that my dad tried in vain to teach me when I was their age. Time and imagination, which is often but the product of time, teaches many things, but nothing of more importance than this, that all men are much alike in many ways. If you would know what your customer is thinking, Mr. Salesman, study yourself and find out what you would be thinking if you were in your customer's place. Study yourself. Find out what are the motives which actuate you in the performance of certain deeds and cause you to refrain from performing other deeds, and you will have gone far toward perfecting yourself in the accurate use of imagination. The detective's biggest asset is imagination. The first question he asks when called in to solve a crime is, "What was the motive?" If he can find out the motive, he can usually find the perpetrator of the crime. A man who had lost a horse posted a reward of $5 for its return. Several days later, a boy who was supposed to have been weak-minded came leading the horse home and claimed the reward. The owner was curious to know how the boy found the horse. "How did you ever think where to look for the horse?" he asked, and the boy replied, "Well, I just thought where I would have gone if I had been a horse and went there." And he had. Not so bad for a weak-minded fella. Some who are not accused of being weak-minded go all the way through life without displaying as much evidence of imagination as did this boy. If you want to know what the other fellow will do, use your imagination. Put yourself in his place and find out what you have done. That's imagination. Every person should be somewhat of a dreamer. Every business needs the dreamer. Every industry and every profession needs him. But the dreamer must be also a doer, or else he must form an alliance with someone who can and does translate dreams into reality. The greatest nation upon the face of this earth was conceived, born, and nurtured through the early days of its childhood as the result of imagination in the minds of men who combined dreams with action. Your mind is capable of creating many new and useful combinations of old ideas. But the most important thing it can create is a definite chief aim that will give you what you want and most desire. Your definite chief aim can be speedily translated into reality after you have fashioned it in the cradle of your imagination, if you have faithfully followed the instructions set down for your guidance in Lesson 2, you are now well on the road toward success, because you know what it is that you want and you have a plan for getting that which you want. The battle for the achievement of success is half won when one knows definitely what is wanted. The battle is all over except the shouting when one knows what is wanted and has made up his mind to get it, whatever the price may be. The selection of a definite chief aim calls for the use of both imagination and decision. The power of decision grows with use. Prompt decision and forcing the imagination to create a definite chief aim renders more powerful the capacity to reach decisions in other matters. Adversities and temporary defeat are generally blessings in disguise, for the reason that they force one to use both imagination and decision. This is why a man usually makes a better fight when his back is to the wall and he knows there is no retreat. He then reaches a decision to fight instead of running. The imagination is never quite so active as it is when one faces some emergency calling for quick and definite decision and action. In these moments of emergency, men have reached decisions, built plans, used their imagination in such a manner that they become known as genius. Many a genius has been born out of the necessity for unusual stimulation of the imagination as the result of some trying experience, which forced quick thought and prompt decision. It is a well-known fact that the only manner in which an over-pampered boy or girl may be made to become useful is by forcing him or her to become self-sustaining. This calls for the exercise of both imagination and decision, neither of which would be used except out of necessity. The Reverend P.W. Welshimer is the pastor of a church in Canton, Ohio, where he has been located for nearly a quarter of a century. Ordinarily, pastors do not remain at the head of one church for so great a length of time, and Reverend Welshimer would have been no exception to this rule if he had not mixed imagination with his pastoral duties. 3 years constitute the usual time that one pastor may remain in a given pastorate without wearing out his welcome. The church of which Reverend Welshimer is the leader has a Sunday school of over 5,000 members, the largest membership enjoyed by any church in the United States. No pastor could have remained at the head of one church for a quarter of a century with the full consent of his followers and have built up a Sunday school of this size without employing the laws of initiative and leadership, a definite chief aim, self-confidence, and imagination. The author of this course made it his business to study the methods employed by Reverend Welshimer, and they are here described for the benefit of the students of this philosophy. It is a well-known fact that church factions, jealousy, etc., often lead to disagreements which make a change in leaders essential. Reverend Welshimer has steered around this common obstacle by a unique application of the law of imagination. When a new member comes into his church, he immediately assigns a definite task to that member, one that suits the temperament, training, and business qualifications of the individual as nearly as possible. And to use the minister's own words, he keeps each member so busy pulling for the church that there is no time left for kicking or disagreeing with other members. Not a bad policy for application in the field of business or any other field. The old saying that idle hands are the devil's best tools is more than a mere play on words, for it is true. Give any man something to do that he likes to do, and keep him busy doing it, and he will not be apt to degenerate into a disorganizing force. If any member of the Sunday school misses attendance twice in succession, a committee from the church calls to find out the reason for the failure to attend. There is a committee job for practically every member of the church. In this way, Reverend Welshimer delegates to the members themselves the responsibility of rounding up the delinquents and keeping them interested in church affairs. He is an organizer of the highest type. His efforts have attracted the attention of businessmen throughout the country, and times too numerous to be mentioned, he has been offered positions at fancy salaries by banks, steel plants, business houses, etc., that recognized him as a real leader. In the basement of the church, Reverend Welshimer operates a first-class printing plant where he publishes weekly a very creditable church paper that goes to all the members. The production and distribution of this paper is another source of employment which keeps the church members out of mischief, as practically all of them take some sort of an active interest in it. The paper is devoted exclusively to the affairs of the church as a whole and those of the individual members. It is read by each member, line by line, because there is always a chance that each member's name may be mentioned in the news locals. The church has a well-trained choir and an orchestra that would be a credit to some of the largest theaters. Here, Reverend Welchheimer serves the double purpose of supplying entertainment and at the same time keeping the more temperamental members who are artists employed so they also remain out of mischief, incidentally giving them a chance to do that which they like best. The late Dr. Harper, who was formerly president of the University of Chicago, was one of the most efficient college presidents of his time. He had a penchant for raising funds in large amounts. It was he who induced John D. Rockefeller to contribute millions of dollars to the support of the University of Chicago. It may be helpful to the students of this philosophy to study Dr. Harper's techniques, because he was a leader of the highest order. Moreover, I have his own word for it that his leadership was never a matter of chance or accident, but always the result of a carefully planned procedure. The following incident will serve to show just how Dr. Harper made use of imagination in raising money in large sums. He needed an extra $1 million for the construction of a new building. Taking inventory of the wealthy men of Chicago to whom he might turn for this large sum, he decided upon two men, each of whom was a millionaire, and both were bitter enemies. One of these men was, at the time, the head of the Chicago Street Railway System. Choosing the noon hour, when the office force and this man's secretary in particular would be apt to be out at lunch, Dr. Harper nonchalantly strolled into the office and, finding no one on guard at the outer door, walked into the office of the intended victim, whom he surprised by his appearance unannounced. "My name is Harper," said the doctor, "and I am president of the University of Chicago. Pardon my intrusion, but I found no one in the outer office," which was, of course, no mere accident. "So I took the liberty of walking on in. I have thought of you and your street railway system many times. You have built up a wonderful system, and I understand that you have made lots of money for your effort. I never think of you, however, without it occurring to me that one of these days you will be passing out into the great unknown, and after you are gone there will be nothing left as a monument to your name, because others will take over your money, and money has a way of losing its identity very quickly, as soon as it changes hands. I have often thought of your offspring, your opportunity to perpetuate your name by permitting you to build a new hall out of university grounds and naming it after you. I would have offered you this opportunity long ago had it not been for the fact that one of the members of our board wishes the honor to go to Mr. X, the streetcar's head's enemy. Personally, however, I have always favored you, and I still favor you. And if I have your permission to do so, I am going to try to swing the opposition over to you. I have not come to ask for any decision today. However, as I was just passing by and thought it'd be a good time to drop in and meet you, think the matter over, and if you wish to talk to me about it again, telephone me at your leisure. Good day, sir. I am happy to have had this opportunity of meeting you." With this, he bowed himself out without giving the head of the streetcar company a chance to say either yes or no. In fact, the streetcar man had very little chance to do any talking. Dr. Harper did the talking. That was as he planned it to be. He went into the office merely to plant the seed, believing that it would germinate and spring into life in due time. His belief was not without foundation. He had hardly returned to his office at the university when the telephone rang. The streetcar man was on the other end of the wire. He asked for an appointment with Dr. Harper, which was granted, and the two met in Dr. Harper's office the next morning, and the check for $1 million was in Dr. Harper's hands an hour later. Despite the fact that Dr. Harper was a small, rather insignificant-looking man, it was said of him that he had a way about him that enabled him to get everything he went after. And as to this way that he was reputed to have, what was it? It was nothing more nor less than his understanding of the power of imagination. Suppose he had gone to the office of the streetcar head and asked for an appointment. Sufficient time would have elapsed between the time he called and the time when he would have actually seen this man, to have enabled the latter to anticipate the reason for his call, and also to formulate a good, logical excuse for saying no. Suppose, again, he had opened his interview with the streetcar man something like this: The university is badly in need of funds, and I have come to ask your help. You have made lots of money, and you owe something to the community in which you have made it, which perhaps was true. If you will give us $1 million, we will place your name on a new hall that we wish to build. What might have been the result? In the first place, there would have been no motive suggested that was sufficiently appealing to sway the mind of the streetcar man. While it may have been true that he owed something to the community from which he had made a fortune, he probably would have not admitted the fact. In the second place, he would have enjoyed the position of being on the offensive instead of the defensive style of the proposal. But Dr. Harper, shrewd in the use of imagination as he was, provided for just such contingencies by the way he stated his case. First, he placed the streetcar man on the defensive by informing him that it was not certain that he, Dr. Harper, could get the permission of his board to accept the money and name the hall after the streetcar man. In the second place, he intensified the desire of the streetcar man to have his name on the building because of the thought that his enemy and competitor might get the honor of it. Moreover, this was no accident either. Dr. Harper had made a powerful appeal to one of the most common of all human weaknesses by showing this streetcar man how to perpetuate his own name, all of which required a practical application of the law of imagination. Dr. Harper was a master salesman. When he asked men for money, he always paved the way for success by planting in the mind of the man of whom he asked it for a good sound reason why the money should be given, a reason which emphasized some advantage accruing to the man as a result of the gift. Often this would take on the form of a business advantage. Again, it would take on the nature of an appeal to that part of man's nature which prompts him to wish to perpetuate his name so it will live after him. But always the request for money was carried out according to a plan that had been carefully thought out, embellished and smoothed down with the use of imagination. While the law of success philosophy was in the embryonic stage, long before it had been organized into a systematic course of instruction and reduced to textbook, the author was lecturing on his philosophy in a small town in Illinois. One of the members of the audience was a young life insurance salesman who had but recently taken up that line of work. After hearing what was said on the subject of imagination, he began to apply what he had heard to his own problem of selling life insurance. Something was said during the lecture about the value of allied effort, through which men may enjoy greater success by cooperative effort, through a working arrangement under each boost the interest of another. Taking this suggestion as his cue, the young man in question immediately formulated a plan where he gained the cooperation of a group of businessmen who were in no way connected with the insurance business. Going to the leading grocer in his town, he made arrangements with that grocer to give a $1,000 insurance policy to every customer purchasing no less than $50 worth of grocery each month. He then made it a part of his business to inform people of his arrangement and brought in many new customers. The groceryman had a large, neatly lettered card placed in his store, informing his customers of this offer of free insurance, thus helping himself by offering all his customers an inducement to do all their trading in the grocery line with him. This young life insurance man then went to the leading gasoline filling station owner in the town and made arrangements with him to insure all customers who purchased all their gasoline, oil, and other motor supplies from him. Next, he went to the leading restaurant in the town and made a similar arrangement with the owner. Incidentally, this alliance proved to be quite profitable to the restaurant man, who promptly began an advertising campaign in which he stated that his food was so pure, wholesome, and good that all who ate at his place regularly would be apt to live much longer. Therefore, he would insure the life of each regular customer for $1,000. The life insurance salesman then made arrangements with a local builder and real estate man to insure the life of each person buying property from him for an amount sufficient to pay off the balance due on the property in case the purchaser died before payments were complete. The young man in question is now the general agent for one of the largest life insurance companies in the United States, with headquarters in one of the largest cities in Ohio, and his income now averages well above $25,000 a year. The turning point in his life came when he discovered how he might make practical use of the law of imagination. There is no patent on this plan. It may be duplicated over and over again by other life insurance men who know the value of imagination. Just now, if I were engaged in selling life insurance, I think I should make use of this plan by aligning myself with a group of automobile distributors in each of several cities, thus enabling them to sell more automobiles and at the same time providing for the sale of a large amount of life insurance through their effort. Financial success is not difficult to achieve after one learns how to make practical use of creative imagination. Someone with sufficient initiative and leadership and the necessary imagination will duplicate the fortunes being made each year by the owners of 5- and 10-cent stores, by developing a system of marketing the same sort of goods now sold in these stores with the aid of vending machines. This will save a fortune in clerk hire, insure against theft, and cut down the overhead of store operation in many other ways. Such a system can be conducted just as successfully as food can be dispensed with the aid of automatic vending machines. The seed of the idea has been here sown. It is yours for the taking. Someone with an inventive turn of mind is going to make a fortune and at the same time save thousands of lives each year by perfecting an automatic railroad crossing control that will reduce the number of automobile accidents on crossing. The system, when perfected, will work somewhat after this fashion. 100 yards or so before reaching the railroad crossing, the automobile will cross a platform, somewhat of an order of a large-scale platform, used for weighing heavy objects, and the weight of the automobile will lower the gate and ring a gong. This will force the automobile to slow down. After the lapse of 1 minute, the gate will rise again, and the car may continue on its way. Meanwhile, there will have been plenty of time for observation of the track in both directions to make sure that no trains are approaching. Imagination, plus some mechanical skill, will give the motorist this much-needed safeguard and make the man who perfects the system all the money he needs and much more besides. Some inventor who understands the value of imagination and has a working knowledge of the radio principle may make a fortune by perfecting a burglar alarm system that will signal police headquarters and at the same time switch on lights and ring a gong in the place about to be burglarized, with the aid of apparatus similar to that now used for broadcasting. Any farmer with enough imagination to create a plan, plus the use of a list of all automobile licenses issued in the state, may easily work up a clientele of motorists who will come to his farm and purchase all the vegetables he can produce and all the chickens he can raise, thus saving him the expense of hauling his products to the city. By contracting with each motorist for the season, the farmer may accurately estimate the amount of produce he should provide. The advantage to the motorist accruing under the arrangement is that he will be sure of direct from the farm produce at less cost than he could purchase it from a local dealer. The roadside gasoline filling station owner can make effective use of imagination by placing a lunch stand near his filling station and then doing some attractive advertising along the road in each direction, calling attention to his barbecue, homemade sandwiches, or whatever else he may wish to specialize in. The lunch stand will cause the motorist to stop, and many of them will purchase gasoline before starting on their way again. These are simple suggestions involving no particular amount of complication in connection with their use. Yet it is just such uses of imagination that bring financial success. The Piggly Wiggly self-help store plan, which made millions of dollars for its originator, was a very simple idea which anyone could have adopted. Yet consider able imagination was required to put the idea to work in a practical sort of way. The more simple and easily adapted to a need an idea is, the greater is its value, as no one is looking for ideas which are involved with great detail or in any manner complicated. Imagination is the most important factor entering into the art of selling. The master salesman is always one who makes systematic use of imagination. The outstanding merchant relies upon imagination for the ideas which make his business excel. Imagination may be used effectively in the sale of even the smallest articles of merchandise, such as ties, shirts, hosieries, etc. Let us proceed to examine just how this may be done. I walked into one of the best-known haberdasheries in the city of Philadelphia for the purpose of purchasing some shirts and ties. As I approached the tie counter, a young man stepped forward and inquired, "Is there something you want?" Now, if I had been the man behind the counter, I would not have asked that question. He ought to have known by the fact that I had approached the tie counter that I wanted to look at ties. I picked up two or three ties from the counter, examined them briefly, then laid them down, all but one light blue, which somewhat appealed to me. Finally, I laid this one down too also and began to look through the remainder of the assortment. The young man behind the counter then had a happy idea. Picking up a gaudy-looking yellow tie, he wound it around his fingers to show how it would look when tied and asked, "Isn't this a beauty?" Now, I hate yellow ties, and the salesman made no particular hit with me by suggesting that a gaudy yellow tie is pretty. If I had been in the salesman's place, I would have picked up the blue tie, for which I had shown a decided preference, and I would have wound it around my fingers so as to bring out its appearance after being tied. I would have known that my customer wanted by watching the kind of ties that he picked up and examined. Moreover, I would have known the particular tie that he liked best by the time he held it in his hand. A man will not stand by a counter and fondle a piece of merchandise which he does not like. If given the opportunity, any customer will give the alert salesman clues as to the particular merchandise which should be stressed in an effort to make a sale. I then moved over to the shirt counter. Here I was met by an elderly gentleman who asked, "Is there something I can do for you today?" Well, I thought to myself that if he ever did anything for me, it would have to be today, as I might never come back to that particular store again. I told him I wanted to look at shirts and describe the style and color of shirt that I wanted. The old gentleman made quite a hit with me when he replied by saying, "I am sorry, sir, but they are not wearing that style this season, so we are not showing it." I said I knew they were not wearing the style for which I had asked, and for that very reason, among others, I was going to wear it provided I could find it in stock. If there is anything which nettles a man, especially that type of man who knows exactly what he wants and describes it the moment he walks into the store, it is to be told that they are not wearing it this season. Such a statement is an insult to a man's intelligence, or to what he thinks is his intelligence, and in most cases it is fatal to a sale. If I were selling goods, I might think what I pleased about a customer's taste, but I surely would not be so lacking in tact and diplomacy as to tell the customer that I thought he didn't know his business. Rather, I would prefer to manage tactfully to show him what I believed to be a more appropriate merchandise than that for which he had called, if what he wanted was not in stock. One of the most famous and highly paid writers in the world has built his fame and fortune on the sole discovery that it is profitable to write about that which people already know and with which they are already in accord. The same rule might as well apply to the sale of merchandise. The old gentleman finally pulled down some shirt boxes and began laying out shirts which were not even similar to the shirt for which I had asked. I told him that none of these suited, and as I started to walk out, he asked if I would like to look at some nice suspenders. Imagine that. To begin with, I do not wear suspenders, and furthermore, there was nothing about my manner or bearing to indicate that I might like to look at suspenders. It is proper for a salesman to try to interest a customer in wares for which he makes no inquiry, but judgment should be used and care should be taken to offer something which a salesman has reason to believe the customer may want. I walked out of the store without having bought either shorts or ties, and feeling somewhat resentful because I had been so grossly misjudged as to my taste for color and style. A little further down the street, I went into a small one-man shop, which had shirts and ties on display in the window. Here I was handled differently. The man behind the counter asked no unnecessary or stereotypical questions. He took one glance at me as I entered the store, seized me up quite accurately, and greeted me with a very pleasant, "Good morning, sir." He then inquired, "Which shall I show you first, shirts or ties?" I said I would like to look at shirts first. He then glanced at the style of my shirt I was wearing, asked my size, and began laying out shirts of the very type and color for which I was searching, without my saying another word. He laid out 6 different styles and watched to see which I picked up first. I looked at each shirt in turn and laid them all back on the counter. But the salesman observed that I examined one of the shirts a little more closely than the others, and that I held it a little longer. No sooner had I laid this shirt down than the salesman picked it up and began to explain how it was made. He then went to the tie counter and came back with 3 very beautiful blue ties, of the very type for which I had been looking, tied each and held it in front of the shirt, calling attention to the perfect harmony between the colors of the ties and the shirt. Before I had been in the store 5 minutes, I had purchased 3 shirts and 3 ties, and was on my way with the package under my arm, feeling that here was a store to which I would return when I needed more shirts and ties. I learned afterwards that the merchant who owns the little shop where I made these purchases pays a monthly rental of $500 for the small store, and makes a handsome income from the sale of nothing but shirts, ties, and collars. He would have to go out of business with a fixed charge of $500 a month for rent if it were not for his knowledge of human nature, which enables him to make a very high percentage of sales to all who come into his store. I have often observed women when they were trying on hats, and have wondered why salespeople do not read the prospective buyer's minds by watching her manner of handling the hats. A woman goes into a store and asks to be shown some hats. The salesperson starts bringing out hats and the prospective buyer starts trying them on. If a hat suits her, even in the slightest sort of way, she will keep it on a few seconds or a few minutes. But if she does not like it, she will put it right off her head that moment the salesman takes her hands off the hat. Finally, when the customer is shown a hat that she likes, she will begin to announce that fact in terms which no well-informed salesperson will fail to understand. By arranging her hair under the hat, or pulling it down on her head to just the angle which she likes best, and by looking at the hat from the rear with the aid of a hand mirror, the signs of admiration are unmistakable. Finally, the customer will remove the hat from her head and begin to look at it closely. Then she may lay it aside and permit another to be tried on her, in which event the clever salesperson will lay aside the hat just removed, and at the opportune time she will bring it back and ask the customer to try it on again. By careful observation of the customer's likes and dislikes, a clever saleswoman may often sell as many as 3 or 4 hats to the same customer at one sitting. By merely watching what appeals to the customer and then concentrating upon the sale of that. The same rule applies in the sale of other merchandise. The customer will, if closely observed, clearly indicate what is wanted, and if the clue is followed, very carefully will a customer walk out without buying. I believe it a conservative estimate when I say that fully 75% of the walkouts, as the non-purchasing customers are called, are due to lack of tactful showing of merchandise. Last fall, I went into a hat store to purchase a felt hat. It was a busy Saturday afternoon, and I was approached by a young extra rush-hour salesman who had not yet learned how to size people up at a glance. For no good reason whatsoever, the young man pulled down a brown derby and handed it to me, or rather tried to hand it to me. I thought he was trying to be funny and refused to take the hat into my hands, saying to him, in an attempt to return his compliment and be funny in turn, "Do you tell bedtime stories also?" He looked at me in surprise, but didn't take the cue which I had offered him. If I had not observed the young man more closely than he had observed me, and sized him up as an earnest but inexperienced extra, I would have been highly insulted, for if there is anything I hate is a derby of any sort, much less a brown derby. One of the regular salesmen happened to see what was going on, walked over and snatched the brown derby out of the young man's hand, and with a smile on his face, intended as a sort of sop to me, said, "What the hell are you trying to show this gentleman anyway?" That spoiled my fun, and the salesman, who had immediately recognized me as a gentleman, sold me the first hat he brought out. The customer generally feels complimented when a salesman takes the time to study the customer's personality and lay out merchandise suited to that personality. I went into one of the largest men's clothing stores in New York City a few years ago and asked for a suit, describing exactly what was wanted, but not mentioning price. The young man, who purported to be a salesman, said he did not believe they carried such a suit, but I happened to see exactly what I wanted hanging on a model and called his attention to the suit. He then made a hit with me by saying, "Oh, that one over there, that's a high-priced suit." His reply amused me. It also angered me. So I inquired of the young man what he saw about me, which indicated that I did not come in to purchase a high-priced suit. With embarrassment, he tried to explain, but his explanation were as bad as the original offense, and I started toward the door, muttering something to myself about dumbbells. Before I reached the door, I was met by another salesman, who had sensed by the way I walked and the expression on my face that I was none too well pleased. With tact, well worth remembering, this salesman engaged me in conversation while I unburdened my woes and then managed to get me back with him to look at the suit. Before I left the store, I purchased the suit I came in to look at and two others which I had not intended to purchase. That was the difference between a salesman and one who drove customers away. Moreover, I later introduced two of my friends to the same salesman, and he made sizable sales to each of them. I was once walking down Michigan Boulevard in Chicago, when my eye was attracted to a beautiful gray suit in the window of a men's store. I had no notion of buying that suit, but I was curious to know the price, so I opened the door and, without entering, merely pushed my head inside and asked the first man I saw how much the suit in the window was. Then followed one of the cleverest bits of sales maneuvering I had ever observed. The salesman knew he could not sell me the suit unless I came into the store. So he said, "Will you not step inside, sir, while I find out the price of the suit?" Of course he knew the price all the time, but that was his way of disarming me of the thought that he intended trying to sell me the suit. Of course I had to be as polite as a salesman, so I said, "Certainly," and walked inside. The salesman said, "Step right this way, sir, and I will get the information for you." In less than 2 minutes, I found myself standing in front of a case, with my coat off, getting ready to try on a coat like the one I had observed in the window. After I was in the coat, which happened to fit almost perfectly, which was no accident thanks to the accurate eye of the observing salesman, my attention was called to the nice, smooth touch of the material. I rubbed my hand up and down the arm of a coat, and I had seen the salesman do while describing the material, and sure enough, it was a very fine piece of material. By this time I had again asked the price, and when I was told that the suit was only $50, I was agreeably surprised, because I had been led to believe that it might have been priced much higher. However, when I first saw the suit in the window, my guess was that it was priced at about $35, and I no doubt that I would have paid that much, for it had not been fallen into the hands of the man who knew how to show the suit to best advantage. If the first coat tried on me had been about two sizes too small or a size too small, I doubted any sale would have been made, despite the fact that all ready-to-wear suits sold in the better stores are altered to fit the customer. I bought that suit on the impulse of the moment, as a psychologist would say, and I am not the only man who buys goods of the same sort of impulse. A single slip on the part of the salesman would have lost him the sale of that suit. If he had replied $50 when I asked the price, I would have said thank you and have gone my way without looking at the suit. Later in the season, I purchased two more suits from the same salesman, and if I now lived in Chicago, the chances are that I would buy still other suits from him, because he always showed me suits that were in keeping with my personality. The Marshall Field store in Chicago gets more for merchandise than does any other store of its kind in the country. Moreover, people knowingly pay more at this store and feel better satisfied than if they bought the merchandise at another store for less money. Why is this? Well, there are many reasons, among them the fact that anything purchased at the field store, which is not entirely satisfactory, may be returned and exchanged for other merchandise, or the purchase price may be refunded, just as the customer wishes. An implied guarantee goes with every article sold in the field store. Another reason why people will pay more at the field store is the fact that the merchandise is displayed and shown to better advantage than it is at most other stores. The field window displays are truly works of art, no less than if they were created for the sake of art alone and not merely to sell merchandise. The same is true of the goods displayed in the store. There is harmony and proper grouping of merchandise throughout the field establishment, and this creates an atmosphere that is more, much more, than merely an imaginary one. Still another reason why a field store can get more for merchandise than most other merchants is due to the careful selection and supervision of salespeople. One would seldom find a person employed in the field store whom one would not be willing to accept as a social equal or as a neighbor. Not a few men have made the acquaintance of girls in the field store who later became their wives. Merchandise purchased in the field store is packed or wrapped more artistically than is common in other stores, which is still another reason why people go out of their way and pay higher prices to trade there. While we were on the subject of artistic wrapping of merchandise, I wish to relate the experience of a friend of mine, which will not fail to convey a very definite meaning to those engaged in the business of selling, as it shows how imagination may be used even in wrapping merchandise. This friend had a very fine silver cigarette case, which he carried for years, and of which he was very proud because it was a gift from his wife. Constant usage had banged the case up rather badly. It had been bent, dented, the hinges warped, etc., until he decided to take it to Caldwell, a jeweler in Philadelphia, to be repaired. He left the case and asked them to send it to his office when it was ready. About 2 weeks later, a splendid-looking new delivery wagon with the Caldwell name on it drew up in front of his office, and a nice-looking young man in a neat uniform stepped out with a package that was artistically wrapped and tied with a ribbon tape string. The package happened to be delivered to my friend on his birthday, and having forgotten about leaving the cigarette case to be repaired, and observing the beauty and size of the package that was handed to him, he naturally imagined that someone had sent him a birthday present. His secretary and other workers in his office gathered around his desk to watch him open up his present. He cut the ribbon and removed the outer covering. Under this was a covering of tissue paper, fastened with beautiful gold seals, bearing the Caldwell initials and trademark. This paper was removed, and behold, a most beautiful plush-lined box met his eyes. The box was opened, and after removing the tissue paper packing, there was a cigarette case which he recognized, after careful examination, as the one he had left to be repaired. But it did not look the same case, thanks to the imagination of the Caldwell manager. Every dent had been carefully straightened out. The hinges had been trued, and the case had been given polishing and cleaning, so it shone as it did when it was first purchased. Simultaneously, a prolonged ooh of imagination came from the onlookers, including the owner of the cigarette case. And the bill? Oh, it was a plenty, and yet the price charged for the repair did not seem too high. As a matter of fact, everything that entered into the transaction, from the packaging of the case with the fine tissue paper cover, the gold seals, the ribbon tape string, the delivery of the package by a neatly uniformed boy, from a well-appointed new delivery wagon, was based upon carefully calculated psychology, which laid the foundation for a high price for the repair. People generally do not complain of high prices, providing the service or embellishment of the merchandise is such as to pave the way for high prices. What people do complain of, and rightfully so, is high prices and sloppy service. To me, there was a great lesson in this cigarette case incident, and I think there is a lesson in it for any person who makes a business of selling any sort of merchandise. The goods you are selling may actually be worth all you are asking for them, but if you do not carefully study the subjects of an advantageous display and artistic packaging, you may be accused of overcharging your customers. On Broad Street in the city of Philadelphia, there is a fruit shop where those who patronize the store are met at the door by a man in uniform who opens the door for them. He does nothing else but merely open the door, but he does it with a smile, even though it be a carefully studied and rehearsed smile, which makes the customers feel welcome even before he gets inside the store. This fruit merchant specializes on specially prepared baskets of fruit. Just outside the store is a big blackboard on which are listed the sailing dates of the various ocean liners leaving New York City. This merchant caters to people who wish baskets of fruit delivered on board departing boats on which friends are sailing. If a man's sweetheart, or perhaps his wife or a very dear friend, happens to be sailing on a certain date, he naturally wants the basket of fruit he purchases for her to be embellished with frills and trimmings. Moreover, he is not necessarily looking for something cheap or even inexpensive, all of which the fruit merchant capitalizes. He gets from $10 to $25 for a basket of fruit, which one could purchase just around the corner, not more than a block away, from $3 to $7. With the exception that the latter would not be embellished with the 75 cents worth of frills, which the former contains. This merchant's store is a small affair, no larger than the average small fruit stand store, but he pays a rent of at least $15,000 a year for the place and makes more money than a half a hundred ordinary fruit stands combined, merely because he knows how to display and deliver his wares, so they appeal to the vanity of the buyers. This is but one other proof of the value of imagination. The American people, and this means all of them, not merely the so-called rich, are the most extravagant spenders on earth. But they insist on class when it comes to appearances, such as wrapping and delivery and other embellishments, which add no real value to the merchandise they buy. The merchant who understands this and has learned how to mix imagination with his merchandise may reap a rich harvest in return for his knowledge. And a great many are doing it, too. The salesman who understands the psychology of proper display, wrapping and delivery of merchandise, and who knows how to show his wares to fit the whims and characteristics of his customers, can make ordinary merchandise bring fancy prices, and what is more important still, he can do so and still retain the patronage of his customers more readily than if he sold the same merchandise without the studied appeal and the artistic wrapping and delivery service. In a cheap restaurant where coffee is served in heavy, thick cups and the silverware is tarnished or dirty, a ham sandwich is only a ham sandwich, and if the restaurant keeper gets 15 cents for it, he is doing well. But just across the street, where the coffee is served in dainty tin cups or neatly covered tables by neatly dressed young women, a much smaller ham sandwich will bring a quarter, to say nothing of the cost of the tip to the waitress. The only difference in the sandwiches is merely in appearance. The ham comes from the same butcher and the bread from the same baker, whether purchased from the former or the later restaurant. The difference in price is very considerable, but the difference in merchandise is not a difference of either quality or quantity so much as it is of atmosphere or appearances. People love to buy appearance or atmosphere, which is merely a more refined way of saying that which P.T. Barnum said about one being born every minute. It is no overstatement of fact to say that a master of sales psychology could go into the average merchant store where the stock of goods was worth, let's say, $50,000, and at very slight additional expense make the stock bring $60,000 to $75,000. He would do nothing except coach the salespeople on the proper showing of the merchandise. After having purchased a small amount of more suitable fixtures, perhaps, and repacked the merchandise in more suitable covering and boxes. A man's shirt, packed one to the box, in a right sort of box, with a piece of ribbon and a sheet of tissue paper added for embellishment, can be made to bring a dollar or a dollar and a half more than the same shirt would bring without the more artistic packing. I know this is true, and I have proved it more times than I can recall, to convince some skeptical merchant who had not studied the effect of proper display. Conversely stated, I have proved many times that the finest shirt made cannot be sold for half its value if it is removed from its box and placed on a bargain counter with inferior-looking shirts, both of which examples prove that people do not know what they are buying, that they go more by appearances than they do by actual analysis of the merchandise they purchase. This is noticeably true in the purchase of automobiles. The American people want and demand style in the appearance of automobiles. What is under the hood or in the rear axle they do not know and really do not care, as long as the car looks the part. Henry Ford required nearly 20 years of experience to learn the truth of the statement just made. And even then, despite all of his analytical ability, he only acknowledged the truth when forced to do so by his competitors. If it were not true that people buy appearances more than they buy reality, Ford never would have created his new automobile. That car is the finest sort of example of a psychologist who appeals to the tendency which people have to purchase appearances, although, of course, it must be admitted that in this particular example, the real value of the car actually exists. End of Lesson 6. The Law of Success, Lesson 7, Enthusiasm. You can do it if you believe you can. Enthusiasm is a state of mind that inspires and arouses one to put action into the task at hand. It does more than this. It is contagious and vitally affects not only enthusiasts, but all with whom he comes in contact. Enthusiasm bears the same relationship to a human being that steam does to the locomotive. It is the vital moving force that impels action. The greatest leaders of men are those who know how to inspire enthusiasm in their followers. Enthusiasm is the most important factor entering into salesmanship. It is, by far, the most vital factor that enters into public speaking. If you wish to understand the difference between a man who is enthusiastic and one who is not, compare Billy Sunday with the average man of his profession. The finest sermon ever delivered would fall upon deaf ears if it were not backed with enthusiasm by the speaker. How enthusiasm will affect you. Mix enthusiasm with your work and it will not seem hard or monotonous. Enthusiasm will so energize your entire body that you can get along with less than half the usual amount of sleep, and at the same time it will enable you to perform from 2 to 3 times as much work as you usually perform in a given period, without fatigue. For many years, I have done most of my writing at night. One night, while I was enthusiastically at work over my typewriter, I looked out of the window of my study, just across the square from the Metropolitan Tower in New York City, and saw what seemed to be the most peculiar reflection of the moon on the tower. It was a silvery gray shade, such as I had never seen before. Upon closer inspection, I found that the reflection was that of the early morning sun and not that of the moon. It was daylight. I had been at work all night, but I was so engrossed in my work that the night had passed as though it were but an hour. I worked at my task all that day and all the following night without stopping, except for a small amount of light food. 2 nights and 1 day without sleep, and with but little food, without the slightest evidence of fatigue, would not have been possible had I not kept my body energized with enthusiasm over the work at hand. Enthusiasm is not merely a figure of speech. It is a vital source that you can harness and use with profit. Without it, you would resemble an electric battery without electricity. Enthusiasm is the vital force with which you recharge your body and develop a dynamic personality. Some people are blessed with natural enthusiasm, while others must acquire it. The procedure through which it may be developed is simple. It begins by the doing of the work or rendering of the service which one likes best. If you should be so situated that you cannot conveniently engage in the work which you like best for the time being, then you can proceed along another line very effectively by adopting a definite chief aim that contemplates your engaging in that particular work at some future time. Lack of capital and many other circumstances over which you have no immediate control may force you to engage in work which you do not like, but no one can stop you from determining in your own mind what your definite chief aim in life shall be. Nor can anyone stop you from planning ways and means for translating this aim into a reality. Nor can anyone stop you from mixing enthusiasm with your plans. Happiness, the final object of all human effort, is a state of mind that can be maintained only through the hope of future achievement. Happiness lies always in the future and never in the past. The happy person is the one who dreams of heights of achievement that are yet unattained. The home you intend to own, the money you intend to earn and place in the bank, the trip you intend to take when you can afford it, the position in life you intend to fill when you have prepared yourself, and the preparation itself. These are the things that produce happiness. Likewise, these are the materials out of which your definite chief aim is formed. There are the things over which you may become enthusiastic, no matter what your present situation in life may be. More than 20 years ago, I became enthusiastic over an idea. When the idea first took form in my mind, I was unprepared to take even the first step towards its transformation into reality. But I nursed it in my mind. I became enthusiastic over it as I looked ahead in my imagination.